Hello and welcome.
Sorry, everyone.
Oh, dear.
It's the heat. I'll blame the heat. It's sending everyone loopy.
Yeah. Anyway, let's try that again. Take two. What the? History. Hello and welcome to What the History, your fortnightly bite-sized bits and treats of bizarre history that will make you say, what the history? I am Trevor Holland.
And I'm Susie Holland.
And, we've got some good ones this time. So, Susie, what are you going to treat us with today?
I've got another Catholic story for y'all. Okay. That sounds great, doesn't it? It's actually another Pope story. Now, listeners who have been with us from the beginning, hello and thank you, everyone, mwah, 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 might remember the strange tale of Pope Joan that I reported on last year. So, I have another Pope story for you, as promised. This one's a little grisly in some places, so just bear with me, okay? Now, this is a story about how a dead Pope was disinterred by a successor to the papacy and put on trial. Yeah, disinterred as in dug up out of his grave and put on a court trial, which the name of this in English is the Cadaver Synod, or Synod, oh gosh, sorry, and in Latin as the Synodus, or Synodus, Horrenda, which sounds even more nastier, in my humble opinion, and is thought to epitomise one of the most corrupt times in the history of the papacy. Now, let me explain how all this came about. Now, there was a guy called Formosus, who was born circa 816, that's 816, possibly in Rome, because record-keeping was not the strong point at that time, and was made a cardinal bishop of Porto, a suburb of Rome, by Pope St. Nicholas I, who told him to go to Bulgaria, of all places, in 864 to further spread the word about Catholicism. And he was so good at it that the Bulgarians wanted him to be their archbishop, but Nicholas said no. Doors closed there, mate. He was also assigned to missionary work in France by Popes Adrian II in 869 and John VIII in 875. Now, the relationship between Formosus and John VIII became messy in 876. Some reports say that John was scared that Formosus wanted his job and was undermining his authority, as the Bulgarians still wanted Formosus to be the archbishop, and John accused Formosus then of violating a new law which had just been passed, funny that, so no one could make moves showing that they wanted to be pope. So yeah, there was a lot of political intrigue. So that's when John excommunicated Formosus and kicked him out of Rome. Now, this turned out to be not really a popular move, as John was the first pope to be murdered by his own people in recorded history there. Formosus returned to Rome in the early 880s and was pardoned by Pope Marius I, who restored him to the bishopric of Porto in 883. In the reign of the next pope, Pope Stephen V, Formosus flourished and was elected to be Stephen's successor, and in 891, Formosus finally became pope. Yay, Formosus! Woo-hoo! Now, he held on to this post for a tumultuous 5 years and gained a lot of enemies in the church and in other countries for his beliefs, and he attempted to try to get the Italian Spoleto royal family out of Rome. Now, two members of this royal family shared the title of Holy Roman Emperor, and I've got no idea how the hell that turned out. And he attempted to remove these guys by crowning the East Frankish, one of the early tribes of Germany, King Arnulf as emperor, and asking him to invade Italy to kick the Spoleto royal family out. But Formosus was loved by the people, and when he died in 896... by either a stroke or poisoning, there was mass hysteria in the streets, actually. And now this is where it gets weird. The next pope was Stephen VI, who, within his first year of office, decided to disinter Formosus' body, who had been dead for 9 months at this stage, and put it on trial for reasons of heresy and the same reasons for his excommunication. The reasons behind this go from Stephen being completely insane to shoring up support from the factions that hated Formosus, who wanted him humiliated. such as the Spoleto royal family, funny that, or a combination thereof. So Stephen dug up Formosus. Now picture this is a scream. Stephen digging up Formosus, dressing him in papal robes, then he sat him on the papal throne, and then put him on trial at the Basilica San Giovanni Laterano in Rome. Now, a very inexperienced deacon was Formosus's defence, and apparently Stephen screamed at the corpse throughout the whole trial while the deacon cowered behind Formosus's papal throne. And now, of course, Formosus was found guilty on all charges, and he was stripped of his papal robes and the three fingers on his right hand used for blessing. Those were cut off, and then he was buried in a pauper's grave. And then Stephen VI decided that that wasn't good enough, so then he dug him up again and threw his body into the Tiber River. Now, about the people at this stage, remember how much they loved Formosus? Well, after this, they were really peed off with Stephen and then threw him into prison. And funny enough, he was strangled in his cell. Oh, who'd have thought? The next pope was a guy called Romanus, who annulled all Stephen VI's actions. But because he did that, and people still loved Formosus and thought Stephen was an absolute cuckoo, Romanus was overthrown, and the next pope in the succession was Theodore II, who managed to find Formosus' body, but he was only pope for 20 days before he died. Some reports say he was murdered for the act of finding the body. Again, who'd have thought? Now, there are conflicting reports about the next pope, which was John IX, who condemned Stephen for his behaviour and burned every act that Stephen had passed, or his predecessor Theodore returning the body solemnly in St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. But the point is that Formosus's body was buried again properly in the cathedral, where it remains today. Now, there's also a plaque in the cathedral which displays all the popes' names and the year of death, including, yay, Formosus! Now, all I can do is shake my head at Stephen and say, what the history, Stephen? And there's references down the bottom as well, and some books as well, which mentioned the cadaver synod. Oh, God.
I think it's synod.
Synod. It looks like a synod.
Yeah. Feel free to correct us. That's all good.
We can have some sort of like a war of words. Is it synod or synod? It's probably synod.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
Say so.
Yeah. Stephen. Bad move, mate. Bad move.
Yeah, so...
It's a what, though?
Definitely. So he's essentially going to war with something without much purpose, I suppose. You know, just for the sake of doing it.
Yeah. Oh, I see where you're going with this, but we can't be too political about the current state of things on here. We are not a political podcast.
No.
We welcome everyone except that person that we are talking about. We do not welcome him. He's not allowed on here at all.
I'm not going to get any more specific than that, because if we do, I'll probably have to cut it out.
Yeah, he's tangerine.
Anyway.
Shh! Oh, bad Susie.
Anyway.
Back to yours.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. Well, Susie referred to a previous one, an earlier podcast, and, well, for those out there who have listened to all our podcasts so far, and definitely a big thanks from me if you have... Mwah. You may remember my little tale about Hans Island and the Whiskey War. If not, check out our earlier episodes and have a listen. While this episode's tale is not directly related, it does involve another, well, war of sorts with a pretty bizarre twist.
You do this a lot, don't you? I've got the Catholic stuff and the history, the jewels and things, and you've got the wars.
But only the funny wars.
The wars with... bizarre twists. Yeah, not okay. Really funny. Not ha-ha funny. Oh, I don't know. I'll stop there.
I don't know.
I'll stop there.
There's actually a bit of Australian history too. So yay! There you go. We managed to get some Aussie history in here. In the aftermath of World War I, a large number of Australian and British ex-servicemen were granted parcels of land by the Australian government and took up farming. When the Great Depression hit, these farmers were encouraged to increase their wheat crop, with the Australian government offering subsidies. Unfortunately, these subsidies failed to appear, and struggling farmers were left trying to keep their farms afloat and ensure their crops could still be sold. In 1932, another challenge emerged for the embattled farmers, particularly in Campion in Western Australia. The increased amount of cleared land, full of tasty wheat and irrigation channels, proved very enticing for the local wildlife. And by October, it was estimated almost 20,000 emus, one of Australia's largest, and thankfully flightless, native bird species, had descended on the area, setting up breeding colonies, trampling crops and destroying fences, which let other pests into the wheat fields. If you've never been up close to an emu, they are quite intimidating, and for me, personally, are a bit on the disturbing side.
Oh, not Edward and Edwina emu. They're gorgeous.
That's from a kid's book.
Oh, but that's such a lovely book.
Yeah, I've been face to face with an emu, and it's just, it's unsettling. Anyway, back to the farmers.
Okay, sorry.
Calls for assistance from the farmers were getting frantic, and the then Minister for Defence, Sir George Pearce, agreed to provide military aid. And the conflict that was destined to be remembered as the Great Emu War began. Oh, what the...
Oh, go Australia.
On the 2nd of November of 1932, Major G.P.W. Meredith, along with soldiers from the Royal Australian Artillery, enlisted the help of local farmers to try to herd a group of approximately 40 emus into a paddock. Then, armed with 2 Lewis machine guns and approximately 10,000 rounds of ammunition, the soldiers opened fire in the first volley of this war, I suppose. Well, the number of emus killed in this initial engagement is not clearly recorded, but it is believed about a dozen birds were killed, but other reports put the figure in single digits. It was also stated that birds, quite clearly struck by bullets, were still able to join their comrades as they scattered and quickly ran out of range.
Oh dear.
On the 4th of November, the soldiers responded to reports of a group of about 100 emus at a nearby dam. They arrived, set up, took aim, and again managed to kill around a dozen birds before the guns jammed. The remaining birds scattered, and the soldiers were unable to locate any more emus that day. A couple of days later, Major Meredith changed his tactics. He had the machine guns mounted onto the back of a truck, with the idea that they could chase and herd the emus more effectively, and more effectively combat the feathered menace. Now, emus can run at speeds of up to 50 kilometers per hour. However, given the rough terrain and of the area, the soldiers were lucky if the truck could top 25. Not to mention all the bouncing around made it nearly impossible to aim.
Oh dear.
By the 8th of November, it was painfully obvious that the soldiers were not making any significant impact on the emu population. Reports vary from 50 of the estimated 20,000 birds being felled to around 200 to 300. Regardless, Sir Pearce called for the withdrawal of forces in the area and declared the operation as unsuccessful, meaning the army lost. Now, parliamentary discussion of this operation provided some of the greatest highlights of the whole debacle. Regarding the emu's ability to take a bullet and keep on running, Major Meredith himself stated, quote, "If we had a military division with a bullet-carrying capacity of these birds, it would face any army in the world. They can face machine guns with the invulnerability of tanks." End quote. When the question was raised if any members of the armed forces were to receive medals for the operation, Federal Labor MP, Mr. A.E. Green, replied that any medals should be given to the emus who had, quote, "won every round so far." End quote. Sir Pearce also did not escape unscathed. He was unofficially titled the Minister for the Emu War.
What a great title, that.
Absolutely. Now, just to round this out for our non-Australian listeners, hi guys, the emu is one of the animals on the Australian coat of arms. It's an emu and a kangaroo, and the whole thing is neither of those animals can walk backwards, so that's the point of it. So just consider that as you reflect on the fact that the Australian army took on these birds on Australian soil and lost. It's enough to make you say, what the history?
I know I shouldn't be laughing. But I'm just picturing the. I'm a visual person, everyone, as my family knows. Hi, Vic. Hope you're feeling better, honey. And yeah, just the picturing of the emus running and the army trying to fire on them and failing. Oh dear.
It's a truck. The truck gets me. Anyway. Sorry.
Oh, see, we have fun on this podcast.
We it's always lots of laughs. Do we?
Usually me.
And we hope you have had fun listening to these rather bizarre little facts. Now, as Susie said before, all our sources and references are down in the podcast description, just down below. So
absolutely.
Click away if you want to know more or you want to fact check us. And if you want to get in touch, we would also love to hear from you. Now, you can leave a comment on this very podcast on our webpage, which is wthpod.rufusproject.com. You can send us an email to wthpod@rufusproject.com. You can also find the What the History podcast Facebook page, and we're at pod_what on Twitter, which I do intend to use more, or you can even try using #WTHpod. Let's make that a thing.
Oh, yeah. Let's make it a big thing. And also, if you have any suggestions on things for us to report on, like we have a whole list, but if there's something that you particularly want to for us to research and look into and do a what there on that, please let us know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'd like to get you guys involved as well.
Absolutely. And please, if you have enjoyed this, share it around. If you got it off iTunes or you want to get it on iTunes, there's actually a link down below as well, which will take you straight through to the iTunes page. We're a bit hard to find on search at the moment, but we're trying to improve that.
Yeah.
Let people know. Spread the word. And because the more people that get on board, the better. And
that's right.
And if you're on iTunes, why not rate and review us to make us more visible there too? That would be super.
Thank you, everyone.
And, so until next time, when we come back with some more bizarre bits of bizarre history, bizarrely.
There's some words. How many times can you say bizarre?
I don't know. I don't know. But we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with some more stuff to make you say, what the history.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.